I'd like to read to begin with from 1 Samuel 24. I'm going to read just a verse, and then I'm going to read from 1 Samuel 25, and then from Matthew 4. We're going to come back to the two Samuel passages in a minute, but I just want to highlight these verses. So 1 Samuel 24, verse 10, is David speaking to Saul. He says, "This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord gave you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lay my hand on my Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed.'" And then a chapter later is a whole incident that we'll reflect on in a minute, where Abigail is involved, and just hold on. Just hit the wrong button there. There we go. David said to Abigail, this is verse 32 in 1 Samuel 25. He says to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been alive by daybreak." And then Matthew chapter 4, just the first verse. "Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil." Some years ago, Gail and I had a holiday in Israel. I led a tour, and we had a tremendous time. And on the one evening, we stayed at a kibbutz near En Gedi. And we had driven down the valley. The river's just gone out of my mind.
Jordan,
that's it. And we had had a swim in the Dead Sea, which is an experience all of its own. And then sort of halfway along, there is a set back from the side of the water by about a couple of hundred meters, is this narrow, almost looks like a crack in the rocks, but it's a ravine that moves up, and then there's a road that winds up literally like this to the top of the cliffs, the top of the mountain almost. And the kibbutz sits right at the top. And early that morning, I got up literally as the sun was just starting to bring light into the atmosphere, and I walked into the desert. And it's hostile. There's nothing there. Literally. The only thing I found were tank traps. They used that area for military exercises at one point because it looks out over Jordan. And as I was in the quiet of the morning, just absolute total silence, just watching the sun come up, these two fighter jets came across the desert and then shot straight up in the air. They were practicing a dogfight, the Israeli Air Force. But the wilderness is exactly that. And you have to be in no doubt that when David goes into the desert, into the wilderness, there is nothing there. You are dependent on the small water holes like En Gedi for life. I want to talk about two incidents from David's life in chapter 24 and chapter 25 that have to do with his desert experience. Because at one point or another, we all experience the desert. We all come to places, circumstantially if you like, where we face stuff that we are desolate about. It seems that everything around us is completely barren. It seems as if the place in which we are living at that point is bereft of life. Now, David didn't start in the desert and he didn't end in the desert, but he spends quite a substantial amount of time in the desert with a group of men who become his mighty men. And there is something about the desert. Something happens in the desert. Something happens in the wilderness that happens nowhere else. And I don't quite know how to say this without tramping on someone's toes. Essentially, it's not only when things are going badly. Because David, when he comes into his role as the anointed king of Israel after the death of Saul, he falls flat on his face almost immediately. The place of so-called blessing, the place of comfort and prosperity, is often a way more dangerous wilderness than the place of suffering and grief and heartache and difficult circumstances. So we must get from our minds this thing that Christians are only blessed if they are in physical and material prosperity or in comfortable circumstances. It's absolute nonsense. And that's the reason that I read that passage from Matthew. Because essentially, we are often brought into a place of desert, a place of testing and temptation, because there we have to face what is necessary to deal with. And the point about the temptation of Jesus, as we've called it, is that it is the Spirit of God who brings Jesus. The word in Greek, and I'm not going to try and say it, but it means impels. There's a certain irresistibility, maybe is a good word, to this whole thing of the Spirit of God bringing Jesus to a place where he is tested, where he's tempted. You will be brought into places, sometimes very successful places, and sometimes absolutely bitterly heartache kind of places, where the fire begins a process of purification. And we are not talking necessarily, and maybe even most importantly, about external circumstances, the hardship of what we face on a daily basis. We're talking mostly about the stuff that we face about ourselves. The decisions that we make as an internal issue when we are faced with stuff. Now, maybe it makes more sense when we start to look at a couple of these things. Because these places of wilderness, of desert, of testing, are both beautiful and dangerous. The desert is incredibly beautiful. There is a purity about the desert that is just unbelievable if you've been in a place like that. But it's also enormously dangerous. And that's the kind of place that we live as Christians, even as human beings. That's how life is. It has this sort of twin thing all the time of beauty and wildness. Danger. Let's go to 1 Samuel 24. The incident there is the one that we looked at right at the beginning when we started to look at the life of David, where David is on the run. Saul has got together literally a commando of highly skilled mercenaries who are on the way to assassinate David. They're looking for him in the desert. They have no other mission. That's what they're after. They're after David. And David has this group of men, and he is sheltering in the caves near En-Gedi. There's water there, and you are able to make your way and disappear if you need to. You're also able to see quite a long way And what happens is they are in the cave sheltering from the heat of the day. And at the entrance of the cave is the figure of Saul in his royal regalia. And it says in no uncertain terms that he comes to the cave and he squats. He's come to relieve himself. And he turns around, takes off his sword and cloak, faces out. And at that moment, some of David's men and David himself who are sheltering in the cave, they say to David, now's your chance. Kill him and you're safe. And David says, no, we're not going to do it. And he creeps up, cuts a corner of Saul's royal cloak and retreats back into the cave. Saul finished, leaves, and when he's some distance away, that's the passage that we read from 1 Samuel 24, verse 10. It's David comes to the mouth of the cave, and as Saul is disappearing, he calls him. And he says to him, you see, this was in my hand. Your life was in my hand. I have chosen not to kill you. Even though at this point, this whole adventure of killing David that Saul is undertaking at that point is the sixth time he's tried it in various different ways. He says, I chose not to do this. And the reason is, he gives, is that Saul is God's anointed. God has chosen Saul. In a way, in that moment, David has made a choice. There has been a process. There has been... You see, David also knows that he's anointed. Because Samuel had come to his house and he had anointed David some years before while he was still looking after the sheep. He knows that he is there to take over when Saul is gone, but he is not going to be the one who decides when Saul's time is up. And there is a sense in which David looks at Saul and he recognizes in Saul something. Even though the king has degenerated over a period of time, he still recognizes that God has called and chosen him. Just as he has with you and me. There is not one person that we look at or we meet that has not been created and loved and called by God. We take it upon ourselves often to deal with people in a way that is not godly and holy. It's a choice we make. And what you find is when you come to the next chapter, as that chapter comes to a conclusion, we meet Nabal. Now, Nabal is basically he's a businessman. And he's a successful businessman. And David's men, because the desert is such a dangerous place, David's men have been keeping it safe for Nabal, and his herds have prospered, and he's done really well, and it's come time of the harvest, and there's a big party going on. I'm paraphrasing. There's a big party going on. Nabal is celebrating the fact that he's got a bonus. And he's having a really good time. But part of the reason is that David and his men have kept that whole area safe. And David sends a request saying, have you got a little bit of something for my men to have a bit of a party, have a little bit of something to eat? And Nabal says, who are you? Do I know you? He's not only mean, he's stupid. And in that moment, as you read it, David's anger just flares up. And he vows to himself that by tomorrow morning, he's going to get all his 400 well-armed men, and there's not going to be a living, breathing thing in Nabal's encampment. And that's where Abigail comes in. Because she's no fool. And she gathers quickly together without Nabal knowing. She gets her servants and she gets a whole lot of bread and a whole lot of meat. And they list all the stuff that she gets together and she puts it on donkeys and she heads straight towards David. And as she's coming up the ravine, all this food comes ahead of her. And as she comes up the ravine, she speaks to David and she essentially says this: "My Lord, please don't do it. Don't sink so low that you will now attempt to do something that Saul has been doing to you. Take matters into your own hands. Behave in the same way." I tell you what, George, stand up for a second. Put your hand up. I'm not going to win that one, am I?
No.
Thanks. Our instinct is that when we push, when we are pushed, we push back. I didn't ask George to push. All I did was I pushed. And he pushed back. Our instinct, the way that we are trained from little, is that if you are wrong, you get on and you deal with it, if you are wronged. And you're not supposed to be a little wimp. You're supposed to stand up and fight. You're supposed to stand up for yourself. And what David is doing is he is saying, it's well within our rights to do this thing. You see, we are faced all the time with a choice. Do we behave nobly and recognize that the people, even those who seek to harm us, are in some ways part of God's glory and are created in His image just as much as we are? Or do we want to take things into our own hands most of the time? And when we've looked over the last 3 weeks, as one of the passages has been Romans 12, verse 17 to 21, where it says, "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. If someone does something to you, do something kind back to them. If they're hungry, give them food. If they're thirsty, give them to drink." And he's saying, see the beauty in everyone, which is the Message translation of that. When we are in a place of wilderness, we will be confronted with situations and people where you have to choose. You have to choose how you're going to behave. You have to decide what is going to be the way that you live. Is the way you behave dictated by what people do to you and how people are? Or do you have a different locus of control? Is there something higher that you live towards in terms of the way that you behave with all the other people and circumstances that you find yourself in? Abigail, David actually says to Abigail in the passage that we read earlier on, "Thank you for being a friend." And the story ends like this, actually, is that Abigail goes back home. Nabal is so drunk from all the partying that she decides not to tell him until tomorrow. When he's sober, she says to him, "This is what I have done." And it appears that he has a heart attack for whatever reason. And 10 days later, he is dead. and David marries Abigail later on. I mean, that's the Reader's Digest version. But he came within a whisker of behaving in a way that was ungracious, unholy, but was saved by Abigail. We need each other. And we looked 2 weeks ago at the issue of the friendship that David has with Jonathan and about our needing people around us and having friends and being a friend for people who are in need and who are struggling. We need the family of God. We need the community of the faithful to hold our hands up when the battle rages, because we are often tempted and tested in the wilderness, and we get to places sometimes where we're not as successful as our master was. But every time something like this happens is a process of refinement, a process of looking at yourself, of seeing whether we make the choice for life or for death. I think the most important thing is to realize that God isn't finished with me. And we all know that there's stuff that happens where, what's it? I mean, that old nutmeg that says, I can resist everything except temptation. There will be times when we behave the way that David behaved. What we need is to understand that we have the capacity to be forgiven and to start again. And the most magnificent thing is that the Lord's mercies are new every morning. Great is his faithfulness. He's patient and long-suffering, and he loves us beyond anything that we can really understand. But he's saying, this is what you have before you. You need to be cognizant of the choices you make, whether they are for life or for death.